Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Maybe you've never heard of Mark Rothko, one of the great abstract expressionists whose enduring influence is almost ubiquitous. Certainly the writers for the award-winning AMC series Mad Men know of Rothko's influence, using the acquisition of a Rothko canvas to exemplify the significant financial success of one of the head partners in the firm. In this scene from the show, a few employees sneak in to have a look.
I don't think it's supposed to be explained.
I'm an artist, okay? It must mean something.
Maybe it doesn't. Maybe you're just supposed to experience it. Because when you look at it, you do feel something, right? It's like looking into something very deep. You could fall in.
You would have to be pretty successful these days to enjoy a Rothko original in your office. Last November at Sotheby's, a 1954 Rothko called Number One sold for a record $75 million at auction. Luckily, it's easy to find Rothko in Columbus these days. An exhibit of his work is on display at the Columbus Museum of Art. The show is called Mark Rothko, The Decisive Decade, 1940 to 1950, and continues until May 26. And the Catco production of the Tony Award-winning play Red, about the life and vision of Mark Rothko, continues through the end of this week. To celebrate the conjunction of these two events, we've invited to the show Dominique Vasseur, Director of Curatorial Administration for the Columbus Museum of Art. Welcome to the show, Dominique.
Thank you, Ann.
Also joining us in just a little while is, Stephen Anderson, Producing Director for Catco, and also Tori Matzos. She's the dramaturge for Catco's Red. So, coming up, we'll continue our conversation in that direction. In the meantime, we'll also have links on our website at wosu.org/allsides. We'll have links for you to Catco and to the Columbus Museum of Art to learn more about both the exhibit and the show. So, Dominic, can we just talk about what we mean by Rothko? The exhibit, as you mentioned before we went on the air, is not maybe what people associate with him now, but shows the iterations. Can you talk about that?
Right. You know, most people, if you know Mark Rothko, you're quite aware of his large, colorful, deep, as that clip said, paintings. But very few people recognize the work from the 40s. This is just work that's not out there a lot. It's not in many museums, but fortunately, the National Gallery has quite a cache of this work, thanks to the Rothko Foundation. And why the 40s were so important was that, you know, no artist just achieves their classic style, you know, overnight. And for Rothko, it really was. It took him a decade, from 1940 up to 1949, to decide what he needed to do, what he wanted to do. He probably knew that much earlier, probably knew it in the 30s, but he was trying to write about it in the 30s. And it wasn't until the 40s that he's actually painting it. And it takes him a decade to achieve all of these goals. The primary goal is to get rid of the human figure.
And which is kind of a drag.
Kind of a drag, because everybody likes human figures, because you look at a human figure in a painting and you can relate to them, or you understand what they're doing, or you know, that's a tough thing to get rid of the people.
Right.
And the other problem, and this is more of an artistic problem, this is what artists talk to other artists about. It's reconciling the idea of illusionistic space in a painting. You know, we're all used to looking into a painting, thinking that there's a space in there. You know, there's another world, there's a room or whatever, there's a landscape. It's reconciling that illusionism with the fact that a painting is a flat surface with colors moved around on it by the artist. And Rothko had to do both of these things. He had to get rid of the human figure, and he had to somehow reconcile space on this flat surface, this illusion of space. And he does it. By gosh, and he goes through all kinds of permutations. He's interested in Greek myths for a while. He's interested in surrealism, which was very big in the art world in the mid-40s. And then he finally sort of gets rid of this whole idea of the artist moving paint around with a recognizable brushwork, you know, the artist's presence on the canvas, which is pretty important. And then he finally arrives at this moment where it all comes together, and he imposes order and structure on all of this, and voila, you have classic Rothko by 1949-1950.
My guest is Dominique Vasseur. He is the director of the curatorial administration and the curator of European art for the Columbus Museum of Art. We're talking about the Rothko exhibit there right now. It is called Mark Rothko, The Decisive Decade, 1940-1950. It's at the museum, Columbus Museum of Art, until May 26th. So what was he writing about in the 30s?
He was writing about his philosophy of art. In fact, Christopher Rothko, his son, published it with Yale a few years ago. It was probably, I mean, you don't know if Rothko, well, Rothko probably intended to publish it, but the manuscript was virtually lost for a long time, and it wasn't, the importance of it wasn't recognized. It's a lot of musings about art, what art should be. It's Rothko sort of expressing, you know, his feelings about medieval art and kind of commonalities of going back to early art forms, the importance of children's art, the sort of the immediacy. I mean, Rothko was truly concerned with what makes us tick as human beings, and in finding that those sort of kernels of truth about humanity, and then being able to express them as works of art. But it's pretty hard to do if you don't have human beings, you know, acting out some sort of drama. So he ends up relying on color and form to serve as these conveyors of these important truths.
I think, you know, when I put out a call to people and said, what's your favorite Rothko? And it was kind of interesting, some of the feedback I did get, but one person responded, number 8, which is the really classic red block. The one that I love the most is, it's the black and blue. It's in one of the later rooms, and it looks like it's really floating and going back and forth between a blue and a black. And I don't even know if there's a name for it. So many of them were not named.
Right.
They weren't numbered. How do you say the one that?
Well,
the one
I guess,
that does,
yeah,
this, the one that does that.
In our exhibition, you said, well, it's in the quarter of this particular gallery, but no, it's
true. The one
true.
That brought in $75 million is another way to describe it.
Oh,
but.
Yes. But yeah, titles, you know, that's an interesting thing. You can see early on in the 40s, he was still titling some of his works. But you know, what does a title do? Well, it sets up an expectation. It creates a boundary or a limitation. We start trying to, if there's a title, you start immediately trying to specify what's happening in a painting. And by not titling things or by just giving them numbers, that's much more vague. It allows much less opportunity to define and much more opportunity to engage directly. And that's clearly, again, what he wanted to do.
You mentioned earlier the influence of myths on his work, which was pretty common back in the day.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the three figures, a lot.
Yeah, my take, and it's maybe a little glib, but I sort of think, you know, two people is a conversation, but three people becomes a drama.
right.
You know, it's, of course, with the play Red, you have two people and there's very much a
well,
drama going on.
But there are his paintings that I always think of as the third.
There are, exactly. That's a great point. And it's true. I think that the three, he's also very aware. He was very aware of myths from all types of religions. And so I'm sure he's aware of the Holy Trinity, you know, the number three, and that there is something classically ordered, even though it's an odd number, there is something very stable about this idea of a triad, so that the dynamics become a little more complex with a tripartite painting than with just two parts to the painting. So he really looks at almost every aspect of his art that's possible. I mean, where it's coming from, literary sources, this idea of the collective unconscious. And of course, he's very aware of the interest in Freudian, Jungian analysis that was really big in the 1940s, and getting to these common roots, whether they are human myths or religions. And, you know, he's really drawing from everything at the time.
When did his paintings start to attract a lot of attention from people who don't know any better but pay for it anyway?
Well, probably. I think he had a number of shows with the Betty Parsons Gallery in New York. I think she opened in 1946, and she took him on along with a number of his colleagues. And she was really a major force in the art world. You know, she was there to support these young artists who, I mean, in a way, the parallels with the French Impressionists are, you know, quite remarkable. These were well, they weren't necessarily as young as the French Impressionists, but, you know, they were really trying hard to present something totally new to the world, something that hadn't been seen, something very powerful. And then, of course, that a lot of people had problems with, you know, this. It's like, well, what's the subject? What does it mean? What's going on? I don't understand it. So it's not surprising that the when the Metropolitan Museum had a big show of American art today in 1950, they did not include Rothko or any of these progressive colleagues of his.
And that was when he wrote the letter to the New York
that's
Times?
That's when he wrote the letter, okay. Yeah. And
I wondered what precipitated that. Okay.
Right. It was the show at the Met, which was, you know, a stodgy show of all figurative art. You know, God forbid there would be anything crazy as, you know, a painting without human beings in it.
Or unrecognizably otherwise.
Just shapes and gestures and forms, or maybe some strange pictographic symbols or something. But yes, nothing directly that speaks exactly what's going on.
When he wrote that letter with Gottlieb,
Gottlieb.
Was he resentful or was he almost proud to not be included in that ilk?
Well, I think he had actually written a letter with Gottlieb earlier, but then it was the group of the Irascibles. I think there were 19 artists, included Pollock and Milton Avery and Barnett Newman and Arshil Gorky and the whole group of them. That was the letter to the Metropolitan when they were saying, you know, you're so short-sighted that you don't understand what's going on here. Well, I think maybe there is a certain sense of pride, but they're like, hey, you know, we're New York artists. We're right here. You know, we love New York. We support New York. We're what's happening here. And the fact that you could overlook us, you know, purposefully just exclude us, you know, that I'm sure they were angry, of course. So hence the name the Irascibles.
Right. I love that. My guest is Dominique Vasseur. We are talking about the Rothko exhibit at the Columbus Museum of Art. Coming up, we're going to talk about the Cat co-production of the play Red, about the life and vision of Mark Rothko. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, 36 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine and a high of 45 today. Increasing clouds tonight and a low of 32. Rain expected for Tuesday, a high of 42 degrees, and more rain Tuesday night with a low of 38. Support comes from ARC Industries, providing business solutions to Columbus's industrial, retail, and commercial markets, and helping people with disabilities find meaningful work. ARC Industries, dedicated to the success of its customers, employees, and community. ARC Industries is online at arcind.com. And support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. We've been talking about the art of abstract expressionist Mark Rothko, known especially for his sweeping canvases filled with bold blocks of color. A local production of the Tony Award-winning play Red by John Logan explores the emotional and philosophical struggles Rothko experienced in creating his work. In this scene from the Cat co-production, Rothko, played by Kevin McClatchy, talks about the emotion behind his work as his assistant, Ken, played by Tim Simeone, constructs a new canvas for him.
Look at these pictures. Look at these pictures! See this rectangle? It's a doorway, an aperture, yes, but it's also a gaping mouth letting out a silent howl of something feral and foul and primal!
The Catco production of Red continues through the end of the week. Joining us now to talk about how they made this story real for Columbus audiences is Catco producing director Stephen Anderson. Welcome as always.
Thank you, Anne.
And also with us is Tori Matsos. She is the dramaturge for Catco, Catco's production of Red. She's the person who did the research for the production itself. Welcome.
That's correct. Thank you. Hi.
Still with us is Dominique Vasseur, who curated the Rothko Show at the Columbus Museum of Art, which will be there through May 26th. In 2010, Red won 6 Tony Awards, including one for Best Play. It's pretty much a 90-minute argument, verging on bickering sometimes, over what makes art and what validates art. Why argue with his assistant? I was one of my questions. Why not his contemporaries? Why not, you know, Gorky or something like someone like that? The guys, you know, the guys like Pollock and de Kooning and Kandinsky and all that sort of thing. Stephen, what's your sense about a show like this and why the conversation with those two people?
Right. Well, I think it's really we found out when Rothko's son was here at the museum to speak that his assistant was never even in the room when he was working. So, but he needed someone to talk to, and there needed to be some sort of additional arc, I think. And frankly, I was like the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I was not interested in Rothko's work before I saw the play. And I was going to New York, and I'd seen some of it, and I'd been to London to the New Tate, and, you know, the Tate Modern, and seen some of it, but I honestly didn't get it and was happy to just say so. And a colleague said, well, you need to see Red. And I said, there's lots of things I want to see. I'm only there for a short time. And he said, no, this is the play of the century. You have to see this. And so I went and I was just stunned by the fact that the play gave me an entry point to Rothko's work to a point where now I was just fascinated to see how he got there in the exhibition at the museum and what his struggle was. And so I think that many people who are like I was, who say abstract expressionism, no, I like to see the human figure. I like to, you know, we'll find that they are new converts.
Tori, what do you do and how did you prepare for this particular production? What did you need to know?
Quite a bit.
She's got several notes.
I do. My job in particular was, for the most part, providing support in the form of research, as you said, mainly to the actors and the director in terms of what they're talking about, who they're talking about. Again, these grand arguments about style and art history and just making sure that they're informed as to why does Rembrandt come up in a particular moment? Why does Turner come up in a particular moment? There's reasons for that. There's reasons that Rothko is identifying those specific people and making sure that the actors are clear on why and why that is and who those influential people would have been to Rothko.
To what extent will a playwright examine those things for you and explain?
I think in this case, Tori probably has something to say about this too. In this case, the playwright had a lot to say.
Okay.
The playwright it certainly had opinions that Christopher Rothko didn't agree with completely. He's very quick to say, this is a play about my father's vision, but it's not a play about my father. And there are even some inaccuracies of time that don't really matter within the drama because it's about truth of the capital T, not is this true? Is this when this happened?
Yeah, and I would say that John Logan was very purposeful in making the choices that he did, and he at some point had said he was not only interested in writing a work play, a play that shows the work that is done in the artist's studio, but also he said at one point he had wanted to write a play about fathers and sons, and we hear in the play about the the child must banish the father, I believe, you kill. Know, one of the characters, or kill.
Murder.
Oh,
yeah.
Dear.
It's not just banish.
Oh, my. And we get that argument with, you know, pop art and abstract expressionism and what's going on at that period of time.
Where they had to exactly. go away from or let go of or get rid of.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, what went before?
And there's a line about how tragic it is to become superfluous in your own lifetime. You know, there's that grappling with that, mm-hmm.
and,
certainly.
And doesn't Rothko even say something about that they killed cubism?
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
That he and his colleagues yeah. killed cubism, which was like, oh, you know,
right.
the great art form of the 20th century. So.
And yet during the course of the story, he's preparing probably what would be considered like a masterpiece mm-hmm. series of canvases for the Four Seasons. Mm-hmm. And they're paying him the inordinate amount of money of something like $36,000, which was a lot of money back then.
And it is now too, by the way, Anne.
it's
a lot of cash
lot of
now too.
Yeah, I take it. I take it. Good point. All of us in nonprofits. That was kind of interesting. How much did you need to know about the Four Seasons and what that represented?
Certainly, we needed to know what Rothko would have known, and certainly how he felt about it. You mentioned earlier, you know, that his art was attracting those who didn't know any better and paid for it anyway. And he resented that about these people that he, you know, the wealthy and affluent that would have been eating at the Four Seasons. He wasn't particularly fond of them. And so just knowing his intentions in terms of what he intended to put in the Four Seasons, it wasn't very appetizing, frankly.
And he ended up
giving
them back their money.
Giving them back their money and not having them hang there. Because he went to the restaurant and realized that now whether he thought, and Dominique can speak to this, I mean, it's one of the ironies here is that he was so against being referred to as art, as decoration, and yet he accepted a commission to literally decorate a very expensive restaurant.
Probably one of the most famous restaurants in the world
right.
yeah. by then.
Absolutely.
And so the question becomes, you know, did he just take the money or did he, in fact, want to try to use that as a forum to make a point? I don't know. It seems like a kind of weak point. I think maybe he sort of went, my own opinion is that perhaps he took the money and then really realized that he couldn't do it, that his spirit, his soul was incapable of that.
I'm trying to find if I can figure out what he said about what he wanted people to do about that. Oh, about what he thought about what he was painting for and the people at the Four Seasons, and he wanted it to devour them or make them lose their appetite.
Yes,
that was
right.
that
yes,
it.
That's right.
Yeah, it's kind of
he's a fiery character.
Yeah,
Rothko.
Yeah. Well, and he is. He sounded like he was angry a lot, but I know that in the interview with his son. He said, well, that wasn't really the way he was.
I think passionate more than angry.
Yeah.
Probably. And I suppose for the drama of the play, you have to have that sort of tension that's constantly there that shows the drive of this man to get where he's going.
And yet there's deep tenderness in the play, too. I mean, I never fail to be moved by the moment when he fires his assistant and says, you know what? Go out into the world. You've learned all you can here. And first he tries to pretend like you know, he's done with him. He talks too much. He's hard to have around. He says horrible things to him. And then finally he says, go. It's your turn.
And it made me feel like that's how he must feel about his art a lot, too.
Mm-hmm. He speaks very protectively of his paintings. Mm-hmm. At one point in the play, talks about, I hope they will forgive me for sending them out into the world. You know, it depends on the sensitivity of the eye of the viewer. He talks about, and he fears that they won't all be viewed with a sensitive eye, and that the paintings will be hurt by that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the great artist Mark Rothko. He has an there is an exhibition of his work at the Columbus Museum of Art. It's called Mark Rothko, The Decisive Decade, 1940 to 1950, and also the Catco production through this week. If you want more information about that, you can check out the links on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. What do you want to know about Mark Rothko? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, I posted out there, what's your favorite Rothko? Maybe there isn't a number associated with yours, but you can give us a call and describe it anyways. And of course, if you have any questions or comments for our guests, those are welcome as well. You can go to our Facebook page as well to post them. So he wasn't necessarily an angry person. His painting sold for a lot of money, even back during the time frame of this play. How did you research the studio he worked in? What did you make of the seeming dinginess and austerity? I wondered about that.
I recall in our first production meeting, the scenic designer came in with basically a complete model, very thrilled to dig into what was, you know, obviously a real space on Bowery Street, and had previously been a YMCA sort of gymnasium space. Oh.
So some photographs did exist. Okay. Michael Brewer, the scenic designer, was a painter first. And so this was a gift to him,
yeah,
to be able to do a to design a play about,
right? Yeah, yeah.
And he took it very seriously. And so he did do incredible research about what it would have looked like. And when you go into that space, as you know, it's looming. You feel like you're engulfed in this studio and these huge canvases.
Yeah, he didn't get, correct me if I'm wrong, he didn't like to work with natural light.
Well, I think that's probably true. He, in fact, in his exhibitions, whether they were in museums or commercial galleries, he wanted the light very, very low. In fact, I have to admit, I think at the Columbus Museum of Art, our lighting is probably a little high, but it's meant for the viewer. It's meant so the people can see them, but probably he would, if Rothko were to walk through the show, he'd say, cut those lights down at least half as much. I mean,
I want more mystery.
Yeah, he seemed to have been called controlling about lighting. And in the play, he says it's not controlling, it's protective.
Yeah, he really wants, he wants the experience to be much more mysterious and much, you know, too much light, as in the play, you're sort of blinded. You don't see the painting. You're not really looking into the painting as he wants you to. So, interesting point.
Pat in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Welcome, Pat.
Say, I've been a docent for many, many years at the Columbus Museum of Art, and a group of we docents went to see Reds the other day, and we thought it was not only enjoyable, but it gave you such an insight into Rothko. And the assistant, of course, serves as a foil. So the two of them go back and forth, and he argue about certain things that they're trying to do. But you don't. I can see maybe I did not hear his son speak, Christopher, but I know you don't get from this play anything about his home life or his family life, and maybe he was a good father, and maybe he was, you know, not as irascible, let's say, or as opinionated about things. And you don't get that side of him, but you do get both the gentleman that plays Rothko and his assistant do such a terrific job of playing off one another. And they actually do a huge painting, which takes a lot of energy.
They do the base of the painting.
They do the base coat,
painting, yeah.
Right.
Which was fantastic.
Yeah, it really is.
It's such a simple moment, and yet it is so powerful.
It is. You realize what energy it took. And the other thing, when he did have to fire his assistant, I remember, it seems to me, the last thing he said was, do something different.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Be different. And I think all of these irascibles, all of these abstract expressionists, I don't think Rothko likes to call himself that, but they dared to be different. They were the Americans who dared to be different, just like the Impressionists did.
Doesn't get any more American than that, right?
No, right. And I have to make one further comment. the Rothko Chapel, which we docents had a trip to Houston once, and that was his last work before he ended his own life. And that is a very, very moving experience, to sit in that chapel and look at all the walls that you're surrounded with in the dim light. And you actually begin to see images. And it's really a very moving experience, I think. So I think that the exhibition and I think the play, are I would recommend both.
All right.
Well, thank you. Pat, is that the Black on Black in
yes,
Houston?
Yes, mm-hmm. It is. Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot for your call, Pat.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye. Johanna, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I heard you folks talking about or calling in for The Favorite Rothko.
Right.
I haven't seen very many, but last year I was in Pittsburgh at the Carnegie Art Gallery there, and I walked into the room where the huge Rothko, I don't know if it's huge compared to his other work, but that big Rothko of, I believe it's the blue at the top and the yellow at the bottom, and it's kind of like maybe half and half, and then there's this slight suggestion of an edge in a kind of a deep red, but it sort of fades out. I stood there stunned. I was stunned viscerally and emotionally by that painting. I rarely have such a reaction to a painting, and so I'm extremely eager to get down and see the rest of his work, but that one was just, to me, one of the epiphanies I've had. And I've seen a lot of art in a lot of places in the world, but that one was just amazing.
I love it that it's abstract expressionism, and yet you can describe it so specifically.
Oh, well, it's kind of like, I can't tell you what he may have been getting at, like sunlight on a which kind of came to my mind because I'm from the Pacific coast of Oregon originally, so the sea is very important to me. But I didn't even care.
Mm-hmm.
It was just this totally visceral reaction of awe. Mm-hmm. The proportions of each color were absolutely perfect. It so worked. I couldn't believe it. And my late husband always said, yellow is a really hard color to get right. And his yellow was completely perfect. And oh, my God. I walked out of there saying to my friends, did you see that, Rothko? I have to say it's one of my favorite paintings.
Well, have you? You said you haven't been to the Columbus?
No, not yet. Oh,
okay, all right.
Gotta come down.
Okay, there's only a few months
As
left.
A matter of fact, on this next Thursday, a friend and I will be coming down because she wants to see it too. So we're not going to miss it. But if you could ever get Pittsburgh, I doubt seriously that you'll ever do another Rothko show, at least during my lifetime. But in the future, if you could ever get that Rothko on loan from the Carnegie Museum.
I'm heading to Pittsburgh.
Okay. You should because in that same gallery, they have a little Odilon Redon, and he is one of my all-time favorite artists.
Okay.
And it's a little tiny still life without the little faces in it and all of that kind of thing. It's just a straightforward still life, very small. And it's just like you're looking at a jewel sparkling back at you. And to have those two in the same gallery, seeing them on the same day was, to me, totally just one of my most wonderful art experiences that I've ever had.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Johanna.
Oh, you're welcome.
Take care.
Thanks. You too. Bye-bye.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back. The
The legendary Boston criminal, Whitey Bulger, who inspired Jack Nicholson's character in the film The Departed, was wanted for 19 murders when he was captured after 16 years on the lam. While pursuing his criminal career, Bulger was informing, too, and getting protection from the FBI. On the next Fresh Air, two journalists who've covered his story join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today. 36 degrees with sunshine and a high of 45 this afternoon. Increasing clouds tonight, a low of 32. Rain likely throughout the day on Tuesday, a high of 42 degrees. Support for 89.7 comes from Home Instead Senior Care, providing non-medical home health care and companionship to seniors in Central Ohio for over 16 years. More at homeinstead.com or 1-800-4-SENIORS. Home Instead Senior Care, to us, it's personal. And support comes from Marburn Academy, a leader in college preparatory education for ADHD and dyslexic students, hosting a community parent seminar, Getting It Down on Paper, the Solutions to Student Writing Problems, Tuesday, March 5th at 7 p.m. More at marburnacademy.org. And All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're talking about Mark Rothko. There's an exhibit of his work at the Columbus Museum of Art. It's called Mark Rothko, The Decisive Decade, 1940 to 1950. It continues until May 26th. And also there's a Cat co-production of the play Red about the life and vision of Mark Rothko. It continues through the end of this week. We have links at our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to check it out for more information. Just riffing on what Johanna had to say. I didn't touch, because you're not supposed to, of course, but I got as close as I could to examine some the layers of color and really as far away as I could to appreciate the floating sensation and the depths of his later works. What do we know about how he decided he knew when he was finished with a painting? You know, Johanna mentioned, well, it was just perfect this or perfect that. What was perfect to him, Dominique Besser?
Well, that's a good question, and I think, in an earlier phase, it's when the artist puts his signature, his or her signature on the work, in which there are a few works from the 40s that Rothko has signed. By the way, it was in 1940 that he became Mark Rothko, because before that he was Marcus Rothkowitz. Mm-hmm. So he actually started using the shorter, easier, probably said name in 1940. But there are some Rothkos that are signed in the 40s. But I think it's the fact that he would release them to his dealer or he would sell them. Clearly, there was work in his studio, I'm sure, when he committed suicide. But I think the play conveys that very carefully, that he's very careful about looking and spending presumably hours studying these paintings. And he does several at a time. And he's just being very careful about the way he constructs these. These are not just slapdash, you know, sling the paint on. Very, very carefully done.
Right. We've all heard people who may not be particularly fans of modern art say, well, you know, I could do that in a half an hour. Clearly, that was not what was going on here. He was not quick about it. He studied and thought about every stroke and what was going to happen.
It's like pixels. When you look at a pixel presentation of something and then you go far away, you see one thing. But when you go up very closely, you could see those layers that he had established.
Right. His contemporary, Robert Motherwell, recalled that he would talk about enduring a painting. And he apparently Rothko said that a work of his was fully realized if he could endure it and it were not a lie, then it was completed.
It's pretty heavy.
That made me deep. Right. Rick and Grandview, not a big fan of Rothko?
No. I guess I fall in the middle. But assume I'm not a great fan of
okay.
Rothko, how would your guests help me appreciate Rothko? I guess I fall more in a camp of classic figurative art, just because I'm kind of conservative that way. But I want to see what other people see in it.
Dominique Fasour?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You just had that very impassioned statement. It was Joanna and saying how this painting moved her so much. And I think Rothko was aware of the fact that there were people who would respond probably immediately, deeply. But I think he also knew that there were people who might not want to have that sort of a deeper experience. I think he realizes that there's the fear. He said he was terrified that these would be read as just merely decorative, pretty paintings that would hang on a wall, the color arrangements, because to him, these really were the product of probably more than just the one decade of the 40s, but this lifelong search for creating great, powerful works that had great meaning to him. Now, of course, how we read them, you know, that's another issue. But he's hoping that we'll be sensitive enough to spend the time and to have that moment with him. And I don't know. I mean, it's some people don't like whatever. I think we all have our likes and dislikes or our predilections, things we feel more comfortable with. I think as with anything, though, the more time you spend with something, mm-hmm. the more open you can try to keep your mind, and especially with Rothko's work, as you were saying, look at them. I mean, really look at them.
And, of
spend
course,
time.
The decade that you present in this exhibition shows a change and shows movement from one point of view to another.
Well, I think what's fascinating about the work from the 40s, everything that's in the classic paintings is there already. It's just a matter of distilling right. and stripping away and getting to the point that he's really working with color and form. And then what he does with it is the great mastery. It's the genius of Rothko. So, but it's hard to say, okay, here's how you get to love a particular art form. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a tough thing.
And Rick, I will reiterate that I was very much in your camp before I saw
just
the play.
Just ambivalent.
Right. I didn't really think it was for me. And the combination of seeing the play and then watching the evolution of his work in the exhibition at the museum, I would encourage you to see both and see where you land.
Yeah, Rick, see the play and see the exhibit, and then let us know.
One comment. I think mm-hmm. it helps me appreciate him from what all that you've described about his life. Mm. And when you bring the artist alive, it helps mm-hmm. to appreciate the work.
Definitely.
And I had thought myself of to take the color like that is to take, as Anne, I think, was mentioning pixels, to zero in on a more classical picture and explode the colors, kind of like magnify a small point and magnify it, playing with the colors that way.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Rick.
Oh, thank you.
From Eric on Facebook, you guys might get a kick out of this. Eric writes, the men's locker room at Urban Active up at Polaris has multiple Rothko prints in it. As a fan of his, the first time I went in there, I laughed at what he would think of his work in cheap frames flanking a flat screen television.
Oh, yes.
Seeing his rant in red about people at the Four Seasons not being able to understand it with all the talking and the chatter and the forks hitting plates made me laugh again. If only he could imagine guys comparing their workouts and primping to the sounds of basketball highlights.
Oh, my goodness.
That's great. Yeah.
To me, so there's something about Rothko. I couldn't decide if you had to pick a print, you're going to buy, a print from the museum and take it home with you. That would be my problem, is how do you pick a Rothko when all you're going to have to spend is $27 to do it. It sounds kind of silly.
Yeah. But it's funny. I've always been a fan of posters, only because if you can't own the real thing, and
right?
you probably can't at how many millions that
Anymore.
They go for, at least it's something that connects you or reminds you. So it's a visual reminder in mm-hmm. a sense. Granted, I think a lot of us use posters as decoration, but still, I think they serve a purpose.
Absolutely.
Although real art is always better.
It says,
need I say?
Yeah.
you include work by a his contemporaries in the exhibit. You even had a group photograph of a lot of the Irascibles, I think. What is the value of that? How does it expand the reach of that larger message?
Well, it's nice that it shows that Rothko was not in any way working in a vacuum. I mean,
he was very much
part of a group of friends, although they had falling outs.
Sure.
They had some pretty bad falling outs towards the end. As they became more successful, there was sort of a, well, why are you successful and I'm not as successful? And or you stole this from me. You got the idea to do this. And so it's really interesting, I guess, the human nature that we start picking away at things after, you know, and groups that are very cohesive at a certain time then start to fall apart as the individual identity and fame starts to increase. But yeah, it just shows that they really were part of an amazing group of artists who transformed, you know, American art in just a relatively brief period of time and made a great statement about, you know, what art could be. A new art, an art for the 20th century, the latter part of the 20th century.
A two-person play is very impressive. Mm.
These are two incredible actors, too. And Jimmy Bohr, I should say, the director. The three of them worked together in some astonishing ways, and the life that jumps off of the stage is both sometimes funny, which I didn't recall. There are times when there's deep humor here, as well as those moments of being deeply moved. It is, I think, what we want to see on the stage is something that explains to us the nature of living, and certainly that's what Rothko was looking for, and I believe that's what happens in the play.
It is the 43rd anniversary of Rothko's suicide today. What in your research, to what extent were you wondering how people who go to the play might think about the fact that he had committed suicide 43 years ago and how that was coming out? Because, of course, the play was written after his death. And
well, the play examines a really specific moment in time,
right.
1958-59, very focused on the Seagram murals themselves. So in terms of our research, we were really looking at who he was at that moment in time. But it, you know, it can't be ignored that 10 years after the start of this play, 1968, he had an aneurysm and was told by his doctor that he could no longer paint these large-scale paintings that he was, you know, he was known for. And so really, you know, what that did for him, that really, you know, he I suppose, went on to do what he could, but just fell into depression and ultimately was found right February 25th, 1970, by his then assistant. And that same morning, I believe 8 of the intended Seagram murals also arrived at the Tate in London. So, right.
Yes, a gift of part of the series to the Tate Gallery in London, 1970, the same day they arrived.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They discovered his body. Stephen Anderson, I mean, is there any foreshadowing that you felt in the
play? Oh, I think there's a couple of times in the play when we see some foreshadowing. There's a moment when his assistant comes in and the studio is very dark and he turns on some lights and he's been painting with red and his hands are red and there's that moment of is this that? But he also discusses the notion that Pollock might have committed suicide even though he was in a car accident, but you know, drinking too much, driving in an Oldsmobile convertible at very high speed, one could, in fact, posit that was a kind of suicide. And he also talks a lot about becoming a noun. You know, a Rothko, that people talk about. You know, oh, I have a Rothko, and how sort of dehumanizing that is, and how different that, you know, the and people thinking they needed two because their friend had one, you know, and a very funny moment, I think, when he
becoming an acquisition,
right? Yeah, the notion of becoming a product, which you know, we see happen a lot with film stars,
and in this day and age, it's the goal,
right? Mm-hmm. To be a commodity,
yeah. Right?
which the pop artist did. I mean, that's what pop art brought to, you know, Andy Warhol and Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns. Their art was about commodity, about everyday things, soup cans and American flags. And but isn't there something in the play too? Although Rothko says he's not necessarily associating black with death, but isn't there something about the black swallowing up the red?
One day the black will swallow the red. Yeah, it hit my greatest fear.
We sort of had that the other night. We the power went out in the building, at
it's
10
like
minutes
Super
to
Bowl.
7, right? And at 8 o'clock it still wasn't on, and they kept saying 10 minutes, 10 minutes, 10 minutes, and we had a full house. And so I said it's sort of the black overtaking the red.
Yeah.
At 8:15 the lights came up, and it was a tense evening.
Okay, so speaking of red, what was the red? What was the significance of red for him? Why was it the name of the play? So many, number 8 had, you know, was mostly red. Is that us acquiring him, or is that something coming from him?
Well, there's that huge list of adjectives, mm-hmm. that he associates, or different sorts of red and what red means.
Uh-huh.
And of course, I think red as a color, you cannot not look at red. You have to pay attention to red. Red will command your attention. And there have been some wonderful artists in history. For example, Courbet, when he was through with a painting, he would put a little dash of red, just a little slash somewhere. And Monet would often put, you know, a red flag. I mean, your eye automatically just goes there. So you constantly have to pay attention to the color. But clearly, it's blood. It's life
force.
It's,
yeah,
yeah,
uh-huh.
It's life. It's
and interestingly, at
fire.
The beginning of the play, Rothko says to Ken, "What do you see?" And Ken says, "Red." And we think it's funny. You know, I mean, because it's like,
well, the pause,
really?
Is,
yeah, right, yeah,
just the timing of it. Yeah.
At the end, he asks him the same thing. Is what do you see? And Ken looks, and he says, "Red." And it's a very different moment because red means something different to us as an audience than it did at the beginning of the play. So we have, in fact, been moved. We have been educated. We have become.
It was exciting to see the paintings come out during the play. As you know, kind of waiting and waiting. How did you figure out which ones would be pulled out and what we would see?
That was largely directorial.
Okay.
Okay, can I just be clear? This is a nightmare. Okay. This play is a nightmare.
Because
huge canvases.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, in real time.
I was wrecked when they were actually painting it. I thought, what if he falls off the ladder?
Right, and priming that canvas has to be done in a particular amount of time because it's choreographed to the music.
Right.
And part of the reason that people lean forward is because they don't think they're going to make it.
Yeah.
They're just certain that they're not going to be able to. So that all happened during rehearsal and very careful planning.
Well, it was a great play. It's still on through the rest of the week, the Catco production of the play Red, about the life and vision of Mark Rothko. For more information, we'll have a link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. There'll be a link there as well about the Columbus Museum of Art exhibition of Mark Rothko, The Decisive Decade, 1940 to 1950. I want to thank my guests today for a great conversation, Dominique Vasseur, director of the curatorial administration and curator of European art for the Columbus Museum of Art. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also, Tori Matsos is the dramaturge for Catco's Red. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Stephen Anderson, of course, producing director for Catco. Thanks as always, Stephen, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producers Corinne Gleckler, Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karim Chaban, Rougeau, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks for listening. Today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener supported, WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.